This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember the comedian and actor George Carlin and listen back to a couple of his Fresh Air interviews. Carlin died Sunday of heart failure. He was 71. Last week, he had been named the recipient of the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor, which he was to receive at the Kennedy Center in November. Carlin was one of the more popular and influential comics that emerged from the 1960s counterculture. His early humor was often about drugs. His long ponytail became a trademark. He went on to skewer euphemistic language and political correctness. He made popular comedy albums and wrote best-selling humor books. Carlin believed in free speech, including the open use of expletives, and he was at the center of a famous Supreme Court case about his famous comic monologue, Seven Dirty Words You Can Never Say on Television. In 1973, the Pacifica radio station in New York, WBAI, played this monologue. After a complaint was filed, the FCC put WBAI on notice, threatening possible sanctions against the station if subsequent complaints were received. WBAI appealed the decision. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the FCC, establishing the regulation of indecency on broadcasts. When I spoke with George Carlin in 2004, we listened back to this 1972 recording of Carlin's monologue. We, of course, bleeped the words that made this routine famous.
There are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7. They must really be bad. They'd have to be outrageous to be separated from a group that large. All of you over here, you 7. Bad words. That's what they told us they were, remember?
That's a bad word.
No bad words. Bad thoughts, bad intentions, and words. You know the 7, don't you, that you can't say on television? Shit, piss, f***, suck a mother, huh? Those are the heavy 7. Those are the ones that'll infect your soul, curve your spine, and keep the country from winning the war.
George Carlin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
Can you talk about what led to this routine? Like what you were thinking about, how you wrote it?
Well, I don't really know that there was a eureka moment or anything like that. What happened was I'd always held these attitudes. I've always been sort of anti-authoritarian, and I really don't like arbitrary rules and regulations that are essentially designed to get people in the habit of conforming and obeying authority blindly. So I have always resisted that in my life as a child, as an adolescent, and as a young adult. And so I held that attitude. That was the fertile ground for all of this. Secondly, I have a strong interest in language that is in part genetic and part then fostered by my mother. I have always taken great joy in looking closer, more closely at language. So those things were in place. On these other things, we get into the field of hypocrisy, where that you really cannot pin down what these rules they want to enforce are. It's just impossible to say this is a blanket rule. You'll see some newspapers print F blank blank K. Some print F asterisk asterisk K. Some blank F. Some put F blank blank blank. Some put the word bleep. Some put expletive deleted. So there's no real consistent standard. It's not a science. It's a notion that they have, and it's superstitious. These words have no power. We give them this power by refusing to be free and easy with them. We give them great power over us. They really in themselves have no power. It's the rest of the sentence that makes them either good or bad.
In your 1972 recording, you talk about how it's perfectly okay to say, "Don't prick your finger," but mm-hmm. you can't say "don't finger your blank."
Yeah, you can't reverse the two words.
So comics work with the power of words. And mm-hmm. In a way, the fact that certain words are supposed to be taboo, as you point out, that yes. gives them power.
That's right.
And that makes those words more powerful for you when you want to mm-hmm. use them. So do you feel like you've been able to work with the taboo nature of certain words and, you know, make that work in your favor?
Well, what...
Like in that classic routine.
Yeah. That is an interestingly disguised way, and I don't mean you were trying to deceive me or anything, but it's in a disguised way of saying, well, don't some people just use these for shock value? You get this phrase all the time from interviewers, shock value. Well, shock is a kind of a heightened form of surprise, and surprise is at the heart of comedy. So if you're using the word in a way to heighten the impact of the sentence or season the stew, they are, after all, great seasonings. There are sentences that, without the use of hell or damn, even lose all their impact. So they have a proper place in language, and in my case, I just like them because they are real and they do have impact. They do make a difference in a sentence. But if you're using them for their own sake, that's probably kind of weak. If you're using them in some way that you feel enhances what you're doing and delivering, that's another thing.
Did you ever expect that comedy routine would be actually played on the radio and it would be part of a case that made it all the way to the Supreme Court and that it would become as important and famous a case as it became?
Well, I knew that it wasn't out of the question that it may be played on the radio. FM radio stations at that time, and there were commercial ones who qualified as what was called underground radio, and an awful lot of liberties were taken with music too, music that had very I hate the words explicit and graphic, but those are the words that would be used by someone to describe those kind of songs, those lyrics. I knew there was a chance, but of course, no one ever sees other things coming that are unexpected and larger, you know. I just knew that I had done a piece that summed up my position very well and sort of had a nice, it had a wonderfully rhythmic, the reading of those seven words, the way they were placed together, had a magnificent kind of a jazz feeling, a rhythm that was just very natural and satisfying, the way those syllables were placed together. And so I knew I had done something that was making an important point about the hypocrisy of all of this.
Before we get back to our 2004 interview with George Carlin, let's listen back to an excerpt from his 1990 Fresh Air interview, in which we also talked about the court cases surrounding the broadcast of his Seven Dirty Words routine.
Did the judges in the various trials get the point, do you think?
Absolutely not. I don't think they even listened. I'm sure they didn't listen to the record to hear it in its fullest and best context. I'm sure they read portions of the transcript. It's in the interest, I guess, of the white male religious corporate paramilitary state that we live in to control us. And the FCC, of course, has control only over broadcast media. And I guess they found a way to interpret that form of expression differently from the printed word and the spoken word. The argument, which I think is specious, is that because this goes out into the home, that somehow it's going to injure someone morally if it comes through the speaker. They don't take into account the fact that there is an on-off switch on every radio and there is a station selector knob for changing the station. The man who made the complaint, one of these moral commandos, a professional moralist who wants us to live his way, sat in his car with his son and listened to the entire broadcast, and I assume they were not morally degraded in any way. I assume the child has developed in a normal way in spite of listening to that routine. So where is the argument? I don't follow the damage. I don't see where the damage occurs in this language being used.
You know, Lenny Bruce always said that when he was up on obscenity charges, yeah, that he wished he could perform the material for the judges, you know, because they were hearing, you know, either reading transcriptions or they were hearing people quote the material.
A cop was doing his act.
Right, that's it. Yeah. And, you know, Bruce really felt, well, if they're going to get what it's about, they have to hear me do it. Did you feel that way yourself?
Well, I feel that the thing was rigged to start with, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think the outcome was inevitable. But surely it would have been fairer to the process to listen to the recording. And the other thing about it is there was a warning given, there was a disclaimer given by the radio station saying that there'll be language on this next recording which you may find offensive. There was the point made that it was in the context of speaking about protected speech. And certainly, there in that case, that has to be a redeeming artistic feature, which is one of the tests for obscenity. Of course, they didn't test it for obscenity. They called it indecency and got around the obscenity law in that manner.
Now, you were arrested in Milwaukee in 1972.
Yeah, now that was more for public, what you call it, disorderly conduct. The concert was outdoors, and the speakers, the concert setting outdoors was in a larger setting of a festival, a summer fest.
Mm-hmm.
And so the complaint was made on the basis of the fact that the language coming from these speakers flowed out of the concert area into the area of the general public. And the policeman felt that was wrong. I think his idea was, he said, there were mothers listening to this, which I don't understand at all. But at any rate, we just waited, as the lawyer told me. He said, we're going to wait a few months on this case until a judge comes around who understands the First Amendment. And apparently in Milwaukee, that took about 6 months.
Did you expect to be arrested? Did you have
No.
any idea this was coming?
Oh, absolutely not. No, and I think it was a spur-of-the-moment decision on the part of one policeman.
And how did they come get you?
Oh, they just came backstage. My wife came out on stage during the show to warn me that they were back there. She came out ostensibly to bring me a glass of water, and it was a large kind of unruly audience and everything, so an interruption like that wasn't particularly damaging to the flow of the show or anything. So she just got me aside and said, there's police backstage and they're going to arrest you. So I went off stage a different way where they weren't waiting. And at that time, I was still a user of illegal substances, and so I got rid of what I had on me so that the only arrest would be for this spoken violation and not for something else, which they would have loved to catch me doing.
You went to Catholic school.
Yeah, I went to a rather progressive Catholic parochial school, which was very much different from the kind of horror stories we hear about Catholic schools, especially in that era. I went to a school where the nuns were specially trained. They had special master's degrees from Catholic University. We were taught religion, but we didn't have uniforms. We didn't have the sexes in different classrooms. There was no corporal punishment. It was very progressive. Certainly for the 1940s, it was progressive, because what it amounted to is that the Catholic Church was actually experimenting with humane treatment. And by the way, my third grade teacher, Sister Marie Richard, will be at my show in Davenport, Iowa this Sunday. I've been in touch with her over recent years. She's now called Melita Conlon, and she wears street clothes, but she's still part of the Dominican Teaching Order. And she encourages me. She says, I know that what you do is sort of in service of a larger objective. And she has given me, if I needed it, which maybe I did, a kind of imprimatur from my former Catholic teachers that what I'm doing is okay.
So you're not going to worry about embarrassing her.
No, she's been to the shows
material.
Before, and I always warn her. And I told her this time, I said, Sister, it's a little rougher than it was 2 years ago. She said, you're getting rougher? And I said, yes. But there are a few things when I think they're just like too harsh, I'll take them out when I do the show. She'll have a lot of priests and people with her. And I don't like making people uncomfortable. I don't think I have an obligation to force what I think is correct or okay into other people's lives. With Sister Conlon, it's okay, but if she's going to have guests with her, I'll probably try to protect them. You know, I don't really want to injure someone.
George Carlin recorded in 1990. We'll hear more of his 2004 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering comic George Carlin. He died of heart failure yesterday at the age of 71. Let's get back to our 2004 interview with him. Do you remember how you were first exposed to four-letter words and what your reaction was when you first were?
Well, I was. I grew up in a part of New York City that's a very interesting neighborhood. I lived literally, my front door was across the street. And I mean literally in its real sense here. Literally across the street from Teachers College of Columbia University. And all around me to the south, I had Columbia University, Teachers College, Barnard College. Juilliard School of Music was around the corner, the original location. Riverside Church, the 23-story interdenominational cathedral, the Gothic cathedral, was at the end of my street. Union Theological Seminary, the largest seminary in the world of again, interdenominational clergy. And around the corner, the Jewish Theological Seminary, the largest Jewish seminary in the world. St. John the Divine was nearby, and Grant's Tomb. So it was a highly institutional neighborhood full of learning and serious people. Immediately to the north, down the hill, we had the beginnings of Harlem. We called our section White Harlem because we thought it sounded tough. But there were cross-pollination between these two groups. I lived very close by Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and Dominicans on the one hand, and blacks on the other. And when you're in those neighborhoods at the border, ours was a little Irish enclave, just a little wedge-shaped Irish enclave in the middle of all that. Highly populated because we were quite fertile folks. A lot of kids on the street. And when you live near the border between all black and all white, you don't have the attitudes that the people who are insulated and isolated in the center of those areas have. Those are people who are not in contact day to day with the opposite. But we did have contact all the time. And when you're on the border between two cultures, you sort of learn to live together. You have a common code of the streets in this case. And so I heard my language from the realistic people in the neighborhood, my big brother for one, but his friends, and then all of the tiers and strata of the brothers and sisters under him. Everybody you knew had three or four brothers and sisters, and each of them were the same age as your brothers and sisters. So it was kind of interesting, but that's where I got a realistic feel and look at the world.
Did language get you into trouble as a kid?
Well, because I liked language, as I sang, my grandfather wrote out all of the works of Shakespeare in his adult life longhand, because of the joy it gave him. Those were his words. I do it for the joy it gives me. So that gene was active in our family. So I had that, as I described earlier. But I then started collecting exotic combinations of curses that I heard in my neighborhood. I was probably 13 or 14 at the time. And there were guys who would put together a sentence in the heat of anger or in some ornate descriptive passage in something they were describing. And they would have an adjective or two, self-hyphenated. They would have made up a form and tacked it on to some noun that it didn't really go with. And the rest of the sentence might have been some colorful verb that was, again, very inventive street language. And some of them were very colorful and exotic and different. They weren't just flat-out curses. So I heard these, and I started writing them down. In another situation where I could tell you what they were, you'd understand a little better even what I mean. But I wrote them down, and I had a little list of them. I had about 10 or 12 of them. There are a few I can still remember. But I've had that in my wallet. And my mother was a snoop and discovered things I had stolen that way and confronted me with them. But in this case, looking in my wallet, she found this list. And I heard her. I came in one night and I opened the door very slightly in the apartment on the second floor. And I heard her talking to my Uncle John. And she was worried about me anyway because I was kind of I was getting like a loose cannon kind of a adolescent, defying, as you will and must then. And I heard her saying, I think he may need a psychiatrist, John. I think we may have to get a child psychologist for him, because she was telling him these words and showing him this list. So, yeah, they got me in trouble that way, but at least it was a creative effort.
Although your mother was appalled finding this list of street words in your wallet, you earlier credited your mother with having a love of language and helping to instill it in you. How did her love of language express itself?
Well, and first of all, just to put it in perspective, the portion of my life when my mother and I were at odds is when you're supposed to differentiate yourself from the adult, the parent of the other sex. And I had no father present in the home, so this was a battle between my mother and me for my identity, sort of, to overdramatize it. But she was wonderful, and she was my hero. She brought up two boys in the Second World War. In an advertising job she had, and She stimulated that thing in me about language. She would send me to the dictionary. I mean, that's pro forma in a lot of families. I know that's what you do. But she would say, "Get the dictionary." I asked her once what peruse meant. I said, "Ma, what's peruse?" She said, "Well, get the dictionary in here. Let's get the dictionary." So I'd look it up, and she'd have me use it in a sentence of my own, and we'd talk about the root or the origin of it, and which definition was more useful and current, and so forth. And so the next day, when I gave her newspaper, in the evening, it wasn't a nightly custom, but sometimes I went and bought her a newspaper and she came home from work. I brought it in her bedroom and gave her the newspaper and I said, "Here, Ma," I said, "would you like to peruse this?" And she said, "Well, maybe I'll give it a cursory glance." And it was right back. It was right back to the dictionary. And another thing she would do with that newspaper, she'd be reading a columnist. Someone who wrote well, and she would call me into the room and say, "Look at this. Listen to these words. Look how that word cuts. It just cuts through that sentence." And she would do all these sort of dramatic. They had an effect on her, and she was able to transmit that to me through her. She was a person who employed a lot of melodramatic things in her life. She said, "I should have been on the stage, George. Someday you must tell my story." You know.
George Carlin recorded in 2004. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. Carlin died of heart failure yesterday at the age of 71. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're listening back to our 2004 interview with comedian George Carlin. He died of heart failure yesterday at the age of 71. Last week, he'd been named the recipient of this year's Mark Twain Prize for American Humor, which he was to receive in November at the Kennedy Center. He was famous, among other things, for his monologue, "Seven Dirty Words You Can Never Say on Television," and for his skewering of euphemisms and politically correct language. When we left off, he'd described how his mother got him interested in language and using the dictionary. Learning a little Latin helped, too.
I quit high school in ninth grade, but first year high school for me had Latin 1. And Latin 1 is when you learn all the vocabulary and when you learn the declensions of the nouns and the conjugations of the verbs. So it was elemental, and I learned a lot about root formations and the Latin, the language that grew out of the Latin, the Romance languages.
Why did you drop out of high school in ninth grade?
I could see that they weren't offering anything I really needed. I wasn't interested in merely having a credential. And I knew I had the skills I needed, and all I needed to do was to work hard on the English language and these skills I had, sharpen them. I had a very strong command of the language as it was, as I was at that time, and I knew that would develop further. And I knew that I didn't really need all of that stuff that they offer, that they teach you, to do what I wanted to do. I was very inner-directed and very self-sufficient. I had an autonomy in my heart that kept me moving in my own path.
Did you know in ninth grade when you dropped out that you wanted to be a comic?
Oh, yeah. I knew that in fifth grade. I wrote a little autobiography then. I said I want to be a comedian or an impersonator or an announcer or an actor. And I had a plan. The plan was radio first because there's no audience there present. You get away with more, be nervous. The nerves are different. Second step would be stand-up comedy. And once I was good enough at that, they'd have to let me in the movies like Danny Kaye. That was my childhood thought. I thought it was a birthright, and I thought that I had a path figured out. And the path worked that way. I just realized later I was a better comedian than I thought, and I could abandon the actor part.
Now, I know you made it onto radio before you became famous as a comic. What was your radio persona?
Well, I was on the first job I had was in a place, Shreveport, Louisiana, which sounds like kind of an easily ignored place, but it had 9 stations. It was a hot radio market, as they said, and we were number one. I had a 52 share. Imagine that, a 52 share in a 9 station market in my afternoon show. So it was top 40, but it wasn't as rigid as top 40 became. It wasn't it didn't sound like a robot, time, temperature, and the label and the name of the artist. You could be a little bit of a personality too. So we played Top 40, and I was I was only 18. It was great to be playing the very music that I was dancing to at night. It was nice to go over to a girl in a situation like at a bar or something and say, "Would you like me to play a song on the radio for you tomorrow and dedicate it to you?" It was a little underhanded, but it sure worked.
Works like a charm. And yeah. Would you talk your way through the instrumental up to the vocal of the record?
Some of the time, sure. Yeah, the first 8 bars or 16 bars or whatever the instrumental intro was, you bring it up first for about 3 or 4 seconds, then you bring it down and say, "Okay, the new Connie Francis just came in," and I'm exaggerating my disc jockey voice. And here at 15 minutes past 5 on the George Carlin Show on KJO, we're going to listen to this brand new one, and then whoom, up with the vocal, you know? I loved running a tight board. We ran our own boards, and I was so proud of tight cues and segues that were tight, you know? It was just a point of pride.
Now, you've always opposed authority. I mean, you dropped out of school in ninth grade.
Yeah.
You joined the military. You were court-martialed twice in the military.
Yeah, 3 times.
3 times, okay.
Yes.
Why would somebody who opposes authority so much volunteer to go into the military, which has such a hierarchical structure?
Mm. Yes. Well, at that time in our history, there was a draft, and the way you avoided the draft was to join. It's an odd thing. It sounds like a paradox, but it's true. The way you stayed out of the military was to choose when to go in, not to let them decide. See, I wanted the choice to be mine. I didn't want to wait. In New York, the draft pool was very large, and therefore you wouldn't be drafted till your early 20s, which would have interfered with my life plan. I had a little plan when I was 11 years old, and I was working through it in my teenage years. And I said, well, I'm not going to get to do this if they're going to draft me. All these other guys are 20, 21. I joined at 17 to get what they called then get the military obligation out of the way.
And when you got in there, how'd you do inside? You mentioned you were court-martialed 3 times. How did you respond to the authority within the military?
Poorly to the authority. I was very good at the thing they trained me for, which was electronics and analog computers. There was a system called the K-System bomb system on the B-47, and I was trained in a very elite squadron, I'm proud to say. It's one of the few conceits I have about myself, but it is a genuine one. I qualified for a highly elite school and passed with the highest T-score they'd ever had, and therefore, but I loved it because of the theory involved. It was all blackboard. It was none of this screwdriver stuff. So when I got to my base to practice this art, science that they taught me, spent a lot of money on me. They right away they tell you, pick this up, put it over there, put those here, just take that. I didn't care for that. And I became a disc jockey in a downtown commercial station instead when I was 18, and I had already begun my career while I was getting my military out of the way. But I was a behavior problem there just as I was in school because I didn't accept arbitrary orders from people who I thought were possibly were inferior.
Now, there's a lot in the universe that you find pretty absurd. And
wonderful.
And wonderful. But when it comes to the absurdity or the ridiculous aspects of life, you're not going to be looking to religion to help you provide meaning or a sense of your place in the world. Is there anything that you do turn to help provide, you know, meaning or a sense of, like, you know, where do you fit in or what are you doing here?
Well, sure. Some time ago, I figured out, with the help probably of some reading that I can't recall now, that if it's true that we're all from the center of a star, every atom in each of us from the center of a star, then we're all the same thing. And even a Coke machine or a cigarette butt in the street in Buffalo is made out of atoms that came from a star. They've all been recycled thousands of times, as have you and I. So if that is true, then I am everywhere in the universe, in an extended sense, and therefore it's only me out there. So what is there to be afraid of? What is there that needs solace seeking? Nothing. There's nothing to be afraid of because it's all us. So I just have that as a backdrop, and I don't have to go to it or think of it consciously. I've kind of accepted this idea that I'm perfectly safe, and that life and nature have waves and troughs. There are ups and downs, left and right, black and white, night and day, fall and winter, positive and negative. Everything has an opposite. If it's a bad time, I'll have a good time coming. If it's a good time, I'm prepared to have a bad time to sort of pay for it. So nothing doesn't really, they don't really upset me a lot, these, you know, things that happen in our lives.
You know, it's great the way you described it, as how, like, the whole world is really you. Like, we're all the same molecules.
The whole universe, yeah.
The whole universe is you. It's this great mix of, like, narcissism and mysticism rolled into
sure.
one, the way
and
you
that,
put it.
And that's kind of, yeah, and that's essentially what we all are. The trouble is we have been separated from that universe by being born and given a name and an identity and being individuated. We've been separated from the oneness, and that's what religion exploits, that people have this yearning to be part of the overall one again. So they exploit that. They call it God. They say he has rules. And I think it's cruel. I think you can do it absent religion.
Now, you've had your time spent with drugs and alcohol,
mm-hmm.
and,
yes.
you know, a lot of people in entertainment burn out or end up killing themselves, you know, intentionally or inadvertently through that burnout with the help of drugs and alcohol. You've also had 3 heart attacks.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, are you ever nervous about death or illness or the prospect of being, you know, physically diminished at some point? Is this the kind of thing like you have anxiety about, or do you just kind of like whatever?
Well, I don't like the idea of not being here anymore, because I do have such a joy in living my life. I love my writing. I love to sit alone and write. I love Sally, and we have a wonderful love together. And I don't want to leave those things, so that will be a hard thing to face if I have a moment or two or a month or a year to face it. But I don't necessarily have anxiety about those things. I would hate to lose my power of speech, because it is sort of my identity for me, forgetting the world for the moment. I feel whole when I'm able to speak my thoughts. That would bother me. But if I were still able to somehow type, I could find some joy and some would be okay. If I couldn't, then there's these people who are completely paralyzed, but they can operate a keyboard by moving their eyes. I don't know if you've ever seen that. They're probably not very common machines, but you can do that. So I thought, well, if I'm paralyzed, I can sort of like write a few paragraphs each day, you know? So these are, all odd, extreme thoughts, but those are the thoughts I think of when I contemplate these fates.
We're listening back to a 2004 interview with George Carlin. He died yesterday of heart failure. We'll hear the final part of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering comic George Carlin. He died of heart failure yesterday at the age of 71. This is an excerpt of his 1972 album, AM and FM. He's talking here about daytime TV.
And then there's Let's Make a Deal, the seat of greed in America. You've seen the people on Let's Make a Deal. You should see the ones they don't let on the show. Take them away. Yeah, but you got to be a little bit dingy, I think, to be 43 years old and standing up there dressed like a radish, you know? And the ladies, God love them, they show that greed when Monty shows the money. Hi, I'm Monty Hall, and I have $500.
Not anymore, Monty.
Okay, you have the $500. What would you like to do? Keep the $500, or do you want to buy what Jay has in this box? He's bringing down the aisle. Jay, you want to bring that box on down? Jay, look out for the court. Jay, look out, Jay. Well, now we know what Jay had in the box. It was a cheese straightener. Deluxe Model 2. Okay, what do you want to do? Do you want to keep the cheese straightener, or do you want the $500? Or do you want door number 1, door number 2, or door number 3?
Oh, Christ. Oh, Monty, Monty. What were the doors again?
George Carlin recorded in 1972. Let's get back to our 2004 interview with him. Who were the first comics that you heard where you thought they nailed it? This is what life is about. Like, they just described life.
Well, I don't know. I know that the gist of your question I can answer. Of course, comedy changed in the 1950s when the individuals emerged, and nobody was all the same anymore. It used to be very sane, very safe. and very same. And then Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, Nichols and May, and a lot of other people in the improv groups and some underground press and so forth, took hold of comedy and changed it. And so it was that crop. And I, in the 50s, I was then approaching my 20th birthday. And Lenny Bruce was, of course, the most, the one who inspired me the most, because I saw for the very first time utter and complete honesty on a stage, and it was a brilliant form of it. It wasn't just honesty; it was a great satire. Even in his days of his just his parodies were great, but then he started talking about religion and things, and I thought, boy, that's wonderful to know that you can do that, that it can be done. I didn't say, well, I'm going to do that too, but I sort of said, okay, now I know that, and it really did help me later to decide to be myself.
How much do you think your comedy has changed from when you first started doing stand-up?
Well, of course, the Times helped. You know, the change is illustrated by the Times. I began in 1960. I went through about 8 or 9 years of what essentially were the extended 1950s, sort of a button-down period. But that was when the country was changing. I was 30 in 1957. The people I was entertaining were in their 40s, and they were the parents of the people who were 20, 18, in college, changing, beginning to change the nature of our society to a great extent. So I sided more with them because I was anti-authority, and I just let myself revert to my deferred adolescence and be one of them in terms of my work, rather than these people I really disliked who I was entertaining, these 40-year-old plus people. So that's how my comedy has changed. The Times were safer, and I was a safer mainstream comic in the 60s, and then I became this other person who was a little more honest and open with language and his thoughts, you know.
Were you performing to older audiences because those were the people who could buy the tickets in the places that you were performing?
No, not strictly speaking. What happened was this, and I can do this briefly for you. I had always been this lawbreaker, outlaw type kid and adolescent and Air Force guy, as you pointed out. Never stuck by the rules, always swimming against the tide. But I had a mainstream dream, and my dream was to be like Danny Kaye in the movies, or to be like Bob Hope in the movies. So I never put those two things together. I never saw that they didn't go together. And I followed this other dream in the way that you did, because the only way you could do it was to please people with mainstream safe comedy. That's what the period demanded and got. So I did that until the two became an untenable situation. I could no longer be myself inside and serve these other things. And when I saw the mix, when I saw the mistake, I went about correcting it in a slow and orderly manner. It took about 2 or 3 years for my change, as it were, to take place.
Well, George Carlin, I'd like to ask you to end our interview by reading the final piece in your book. And the book is called When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? And this piece is called The Secret News. And you're welcome to say anything about writing it before you read it, or to just read it, whatever you prefer.
I have a big file called News, and it has a lot of odd news formats, and one of them was this one called The Secret News. And this was actually written and designed to be on an album, maybe a studio-type album where you could use sound effects and you were simulating actual broadcasting. But it works this way, too, with the sound effects indicated verbally. I'll do that for you. It's called The Secret News, and we hear a news ticker sound effect, ding, 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 and the announcer whispering, saying, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for The Secret News." And the news ticker gets louder, and he goes, "Shh," and the ticker lowers. "Here's The Secret News. All people are afraid. No one knows what they're doing. Everything is getting worse. Some people deserve to die. Your money is worthless. No one is properly dressed. At least one of your children will disappoint you. The system is rigged. Your house will never be completely clean. All teachers are incompetent. There are people who really dislike you. Nothing is as good as it seems. Things don't last. No one is paying attention. The country is dying. God doesn't care. Shh."
George Carlin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you. I always appreciate, and I'm not flattering here, an intelligent interview, and thank you for that.
George Carlin recorded in 2004. He died of heart failure yesterday at the age of 71.
You can download podcasts of our interviews on our website, freshair.npr.org. Al Green's new album, Lay It Down, was produced by a member of The Roots, Questlove, and features cameos and songwriting collaborations with so-called neo-soul artists, such as John Legend and Carine Bailey Rae. Rock critic Ken Tucker calls the result a pleasure. But does it stand up to classic Al Green records? Here's Ken's review. At age 62, Al Green has earned the right not only to have acolytes, but to allow them to give him his proper due, which is to try and help him build a hit record. To that end, he agreed to have Amir Thompson, a.k.a. Questlove, the drummer for the hip-hop group The Roots, assemble a group of performers influenced by Al Green's prime 1970s hit singles. They did him proud, recording in New York, but capturing much of the mucky funk of the High Record Studios in Memphis, where Green recorded his greatest music with the producer Willie Mitchell. As I sit and wonder, baby, how you do the things you do, yeah. I know deep down in my heart, I never see all the way through. I smile. So with all this pretty music and these deep grooves, what keeps Lay It Down from being a great Al Green album? It's some mystical combination of spirituality, that is, the lack of it, and the lyrics, that is, the banality of them. Now, you might say that the man who made a hit by chanting love and happiness over and over doesn't have much need for tricky wordplay, and you're right, he doesn't. What he does need are sufficient phrases and refrains into which he can pour his smoldering passion. That's why one of the best tracks here is the tight, precise construct called I'm Wild About You, with its slamming beats and airy room for Al to improvise grunts and moans over the other nonverbal element, the woot-woots of the backup singers. Theme the new album mostly avoids is the explicit Christianity to which Green, the very active pastor of the Full Gospel Tabernacle in Memphis, has devoted much of his last 20 years of music making. The common wisdom is that once Green denied the secular in his music, it lost much of his tension. But in steering him away from God talk, his admirers have too often replaced it with mere nostalgia, summoning up memories of previous Green hits rather than moving him forward with new ones. Stay with me, my dear. Walk with me, hold me near. It's not as late as it seems. No, no. So why'd you take your love away? Thank you.
This album's duets with the singers Corinne Bailey Rae and John Legend, I just played the latter, are the collection's least interesting tunes. On the other hand, a song written and recorded with yet another neo-soul singer, Anthony Hamilton, has the right idea. You Got the Love I Need has a lightness that compels Green to reach for the high notes his fraying upper register can still attain with an effort that signals his enduring energy. The lyric, meanwhile, is ambiguous enough to suggest that Green and Hamilton may be making an entreaty to Jesus as much as to a woman to be seduced. If, in the end, Lay It Down is an Al Green album for Starbucks stores that already show a waning desire to push vintage soul acts, it's enough of a showcase for Green's senior citizen vigor to make you realize anew that it doesn't matter how old he is or how young his admirers are. It's the vitality and resiliency of the music that matters.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Al Green's new album, Lay It Down.